Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm honored and privileged beyond words to have with us today our dear brother, and sometimes we have a dear brother, but they're not our dear friend. But he's one of my dearest friends. I speak of none other than Professor Takbir Muhammad. He also is known as former Dean James Blake, and he is the author of God's Bad Boy. I mean, it's a powerful, gripping book, and I'm going to let him give you an opening statement and tell you that the phone lines will be open at 805-727-7013. Brother Dean Takbir Muhammad, would you give Religion Means Alive an opening statement?
Assalamu alaikum, brother. I want to say that the book God's Bad Boy is written by my wife, Dr. Bessie Blake. It is my story, but it's her book. And I want to say that I commend her for doing such a splendid job of capturing some of the intricate details of my journey as a youth to where I am today. And we wrote this book. I did the talking, she did the writing, and I'm also doing the selling to communicate to young people that regardless of where you start in life, there is light that you follow that can get you out of the darkness that you find yourself in. And I was blessed to move as a youngster, as you will see in the book, with all of the risk factors for that would inhibit or prevent healthy youth development, to go through those minefields, to survive them, and to be where I am today, a professor, tenure professor at City University of New York for the last 40 years, is indeed a blessing, and it shows that God is a great God, a compassionate God, and full of grace. So that's my opening statement, my beloved.
Well, my beloved, I thank first Dr. Bessie Blake, and I hope and pray that she is listening. She's a phenomenal writer, and you have a phenomenal story, narrative, I say. And I, you know, it's life is very strange. As I read the book, I had to fight back tears because I have sort of a reverse story. I've never shared it on the air with the public. But my story starts also in East Elmer's Corona.
Yeah.
At least the second chapter of my life does. And I had a wife that had a mental illness. And I had my children almost went through that system that you've gone through. I don't want to prejudge the book because tell us what happened. You opened the book with a very poignant occurrence about that happened with your mother, joviality, very happy. But let's first start with where your mother came from. How did you end up in Corona? How did they end up in Corona, New York? And I think we need to situate Corona, New York in the 1950s. Please do that for us.
Sure. My mother and my father, for that matter, are both from South Carolina. My mother left South Carolina, as you can read in the book, very troubled, very upset over a love relationship lost, and tried to change the course of her life by leaving a small little town called Bamberg, South Carolina, and getting one of those jitneys to New York City. And she first arrived in Flushing. And as a single woman, she did housework like most of our sisters did during that time. And she eventually met my father. And my sister was born, and they had to get a larger apartment, and she moved to Corona. Now, what's interesting about my mother went to the ninth grade, and at that time, ninth grade was high education. because most of the folks from Bamberg had been picking cotton and living, you know, doing hard, laborious work and didn't have much time for education. She got to the ninth grade, which made her one of the highest educated people in our family. And what she did was to make it possible for all of her brothers and sisters to leave South Carolina and move to New York. And she took them into our home and helped them to the, they got themselves situated until they can get their own independent living space. But none of them could read, none of them could write, so she had to help them fill out applications for jobs. She had to show them how to read the signs, street signs to get to a job. She had to help them, you know, deal with money. So she was like the backbone of her family until she had that nervous breakdown. And I believe that as a young man, I just saw her as a very strong woman who was always present, and I had no concerns and no worries about her until that fateful day when I was playing a game of war, throwing dirt bombs in a construction site, when one of my friends said, "Look up, man, is that your mama?" And I looked up and saw her jump out of the window. And at that particular point, my whole life changed. And the circumstances of my family changed. But her coming from South Carolina and bringing all of her family up here and helping them to get situated, to me, was a testament of her strength at that time and her ability to navigate the needs of her family. And I'm not talking about one or two people. She had like something like seven brothers and a sister that she helped each of them get established in Corona, New York.
Now, did your grandmother come up and some of your uncles came up? They were very fascinating characters as well.
Yes, my grandmother was one of the first.
Tell us your grandmother.
My grandmother, S. E. Tuma, was one of the first people that my mother brought up from South Carolina. And she was a very strong a woman who commanded a lot of respect and discipline, you know, from the kids. She lived downstairs in the basement. We lived in like a two-family house in Corona on 108th Street. The first floor was our family, and the basement was my grandmother. And so they worked, my mother and my grandmother worked hand in hand until my mother got sick. But my grandmother, after my mother became ill and was hospitalized, she took over the responsibilities of running the household and seeing about, you know, our interests. But as I said, you know, at that time, we were very poor. My grandmother was
an educator. Can you situate, Brother Dean, could you situate for us Corona? Many of us don't know the town of Corona in Queens, New York. It's like another world next door to East Elmhurst. Tell us about those two towns, but particularly I want you to focus on Corona before we go to another famous inhabitant of Corona.
Right. Okay. Corona was at one point called Little Harlem because it had all the elements of Harlem as Harlem was at that time. It was black folks all over the street. They were working families. Everybody in the community knew everybody. I grew up with kids. I knew their mothers, their grandmothers. They knew my mother, my grandmother. They knew my family situation. I knew their family situation. It really constituted the blocks from 112th Street all the way up to 97th Street, and we called Northern Boulevard. Was the essence of Corona because that's where everybody congregated. Everybody came out. Everybody, you know, walked up and down Northern Boulevard. As I said, it was a working class, very poor. Houses were not as kept as some of the good places that in East Elmhurst. Many families packed into, you know, small quarters. The environment almost made you have to be outside because it was too crowded inside your own house, and you got to interact with a lot of people. We had all the elements of an urban community. We had a lot of gang fights, a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of poverty. We had the community disorganization. But one thing we did have was a lot of love. There was a lot of concern, a lot of love. And if you were poor, you know, you were not poor in spirit because you came together with people who were like extended family, you know, and people kind of looked out for each other. And one of the folks that lived in Corona, as you know, was Louis Armstrong, and I can tell you that at the time he was in.
I don't want to get ahead of the story because it's a powerful narrative. If it were a novel, Fisher, the novel, the book was written by about the young man. What was his name? Fisher, last name Fisher, that Denzel Washington played. A cultural life among us, we're going to have the God's Bad Boy, because I think your story is a powerful story, and it would seem fictional like Claude Brown and Perry Tomos, and it should be replied, especially on Staten Island. I don't want to get ahead of the story. I want you to situate also for us your uncles. They were very strong figures. And they didn't seem to be fly-by-night or dilly-by-day fellows. And then I want you to also share with us something about street life in Corona. Because Corona had its own flavor. And it was Little Harlem. So therefore, some of the elements of Little Harlem came along with it. Tell us about that.
Well, let me first start with my uncles. My uncles were, they called them the Tuma Brothers. My mother's maiden name was Tuma, and when she married, she became a Blake. And these brothers came up from South Carolina, and she brought them from South Carolina. And they were kind of rough and tumble guys in the sense that they were big, strong, and really relied on their physical strength to survive, you know, in that Corona environment. So they were so good that they had a reputation as the Tuma Boys. And when I used to walk down Northern Boulevard, the roughest sections of Northern Boulevard, practically every other block, there was a different gang or a different set of individuals, different groups. People divided themselves along blocks or one side of the boulevard, the other side of the boulevard. And just nothing but a lot of young people up and down the street. Many of us were playing hooky from school, didn't go to school, joined gangs, et cetera. And my uncles, because of their reputation, I was able to walk in any part of Northern Boulevard and not be touched because people would say, hey, that's Jimmy Blake. He's one of those Tuma Boys. Don't mess with him because when you mess with him, you bring out the tumors. So that reputation was like a protection for me because Corona was, and at that particular point in time, a very rough community, not rough in the sense of shootings and things of that nature, but in gang fights and rough and tumble. You know, you can get into a battle just looking at somebody, you know, in the wrong way. So you had to group yourself with certain groups in order to protect yourself. You couldn't be an individual in that situation. You had to be affiliated with some kind of gang or some kind of family that was worse than a gang, like my family, that any gang members wouldn't mess with. So, you know, they had to do that in order to survive. We loved singing at the street corner, doo-wops on the street corner. We were very heavy into African Latin music, Afro-Cuban at the time. I played congas. I learned congas from guys up on the boulevard. I learned how to do that African, Afro-Cuban dancing, you know, from watching, you know, people perform, you know, in the street. We had, you know, a lot of fish and chip joints. We had candy stores. We had pool rooms. But the street was really our recreational place. I mean, everything. We dressed a certain way. Wore different kinds of what we call hats, like velours. We learned how to walk with a dip in our walk, and we learned how to talk, street talk, and use things. Hey, man, what's happening? Slapping five. You know, the culture of the community created in us all these conditions of of learning how to survive, both verbally and non-verbally. You couldn't just walk like a little college student up Northern Boulevard. You had to have that dip that said, if you mess with me, you're going to have a problem without even saying anything. You had to let people know I'm a part of this culture, you know, and I'm ready to do whatever is necessary to survive. And so that was the nature of Corona. And then you had older men, guys that were older that had reputations and names. Like you have one guy named Lucky, then you had a Big Lucky. The big little Lucky was trying to be like Big Lucky. The little Count was trying to be like Big Count. You know, it was like a graduation. If a guy who was rough thought you could fight, he said, you can have my name. You're not afraid of anything. You know, so you always was trying to develop a reputation as a tough guy, develop a reputation so the older guys would respect you, you know, as a tough guy so much so that they would give you your name. I had a street name called Spade. And to my surprise, I didn't even know it. Some young kid at that time, after I left Corona, named himself Little Spade because he wanted to be like me. You know? I didn't even know it was a Little Spade until somebody told me that after I left the community. But that was the kind of like pecking order, you know. You had to be out in the street. You had to be known in the street. You had to be affiliated with a group. If you didn't have a group, you had to have a strong family that didn't know that they would come out and deal with anyone that messed with you. Even if my sister, older sister Gloria, she was a strapper, man. She could fight. You know, they'd say, don't mess with her. That's Gloria Blake's brother. Because she'd come out there and take care of business. You know, and all of that, structure, underneath there was a lot of love, because if somebody came from outside of Corona and jumped somebody in Corona, all people in Corona would get together. It was like that kind of, no, you don't come into our community and jump on any of our people, and we don't respond as a united front. So those gang lines and boundaries would just dissolve when we had an external threat. From, say, somebody from Brooklyn. I remember the guys came out, called themselves the Brooklyn Chaplains. They came out and beat up one of the kids from Corona, and we organized and went to Fort Greene Projects looking for who did that. Now, I didn't know that Fort Greene Projects was the way it was. Now, we organized ourselves almost like on a suicide mission, because Fort Greene was no joke. You know.
But believe you me, that was almost a suicide mission. You know, Fort Greene, Nazi Park Project, those are not places to play around in, and including the party.
We had that mentality. No, there's no group, no community stronger than Corona. And so if you mess with Corona, I don't care who you were, we were going after you. But we learned that some places you just don't go. And places like that. So it was that kind of my uncles played a very key role. I had an uncle, his name was Big Jimmy, I was Little Jimmy. He was the type of guy that he would walk into a bar and people would leave because they never knew when he would explode. And he was had fists like huge fists, very strong and very, very, very easily provoked, and if you mess with them, you had a problem. Then you had another hand. You had guys like a guy named Lucius Benson. I mentioned him in the book a lot. Lucius was a boxer. He almost won it's like a championship fight, you know.
Golden Gloves?
Yeah, Golden Gloves, right, yeah. And he was tough, but he was gentle. And gentle in the sense that he did not like anyone bigger than a person to jump on a little person. If they did that, if Lou was not even involved, he would go out and get the big guy. All of the guys did not mess with Lou, and he became one of the most significant individuals that you see in the book in my life, because he was a gang member, but he was respected as a gang leader, and then he was able to use that leadership skill and get a lot of brothers who were in the gangs, out of the gangs, and off drugs. And he built a group out there called Elm Corps, Youth and Adult Services, where he helped a lot of the guys that I grew up with who got involved with drugs, offered drugs, and got them situated in a better space in life. So Lou's a hero. He's one of the most powerful mentors.
Is Lou still living?
Yeah.
Is Lou still living?
And, my wife and I just celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary this past Saturday. And my kids gave us a big surprise and had over 150 people at this place called LaGuardia Marriott in East Elmhurst. And one of the folks that was there was Lucius.
Wow. We are speaking with Professor Takbir Muhammad, also known as Dean James Blake. And he, his wife, Sister Dr. Bessie Blake, has authored a book, the autobiography, the biography of called God's Bad Boy, who has turned out to be quite great. And we're talking about his book. Will you, first, Professor, will you tell us how one can get a copy of this book? It's like somebody inviting you into your to their house and they got a big meal on the table, like your grandmother's book, and then they don't tell you how you can get it, and they just sit in the kitchen, eat and close the door, and they eat the meal. So we don't want to be like that. We want to open the door and let the people smell that macaroni and cheese and that big turkey and all the food. Tell us how we can get a copy of that book.
Yeah, well, there's several ways you can get it. One is you can go to Amazon.com and you can get, you just look up Dr. Bessie W. Blake. It will come on. You will see it. Or you can go to Barnes & Noble and get it. But we are urging people to go to Litlore, which is LITLORE.com. Now, Litlore.com is a black-owned publishing company. My wife's first book, Speak to the Mountain, the Tommy Waits story, which was a memoir about her mother, got the USA Best Book Award. And she had a small publishing company publish it. And most of the royalties went to the small publishing company. So what she did was to study how to set up a publishing company. And she succeeded in setting up her own publishing company called Litlore, LITLORE, Press. And she published this book as her first book from her first publishing company. So we ask people to support independent black publishing company. We can study.
Dean, would you repeat that again? Repeat that three times. Well, you know, African-Americans, they need three times to get it. And others may need. Yeah, would you repeat that again, how one can get that book? Before, not the Barnes & Noble, but the Lit Press.
Litlore, LITLORE.com. Go to Litlore, LORE, LITLORE.com. And you will see the publishing company will come up, independent black publishing company that Dr. Bessie Blake set up on her own. And I'm so proud of her because now when we sell this book, it doesn't go to anyone other than ourselves. And that's the way it should be. Why should we get into this business of producing books and we don't have control over the proceeds that come to the book? So I'm very proud of her. I mean, I can talk about her all day in terms of her writing ability, her ability to take the reader and put them right into the setting, her ability to move the storyline in a way in which captivates the reader. Everyone who has read God's Bad Boy have called and said it is one of the most important books that they have ever read. I had a brother call me and he said, "Brother, if I had read this book before I got divorced, I would still be married because the lessons in this book are so powerful and I can relate to them." So it comes from the young folks at the college who are reading the book, young people in the community, older people, teachers, social workers, et cetera, because it is a how do you get over the hump book. It is a book that says that it's no time for self-pity. It's time to get up and do something for yourself. This book is about helping young people understand that all of us have a journey that we have to take, that nobody is where we are just because we are who we are. We're where we are because we struggled. One of the greatest motivations I had for telling this personal story that you read in this book is because I had students come to me constantly, students in academic difficulty. They would say, oh, Professor Blake, you know, I couldn't do this because my mother died. I couldn't do this because my sister's this. I couldn't do this because I don't have a job. I couldn't do this because, you know, and they would say, and you don't understand, Professor. So you're a professor. You don't understand. No, I do understand. And I felt that they thought that maybe I, because I was a professor, you know, at a university, that I never had a struggle, that I had all A's all my life. I went to school and never played hooky. I did all the things that was what I was supposed to do.
Dean, before you tell the rest of the story, we're going to tease the rest of it out because we're going to go right back to Corona, and okay. We're going to go to that fateful day. And I think you were about 10 years old when that happened. And all hell broke loose for your sister. You all started coming to school somewhat disheveled. It developed in you certain sets of feelings, or as they say in New Jersey, you felt some kind of way. Share with us that. What was that moment like when you saw your mother and heard that your mother jumped out of the window? Did you understand what had happened?
I didn't really understand what happened in a sense, other than the fact of my great concern for my mother, and that I didn't understand. When I say didn't understand what had happened, I didn't understand why she did that, because my life was idyllic up to that point, you know. And then when she did that, you know, there was a dramatic change, not only in our life but her. But there were signs that we all, I guess the adults at the time, my grandmother, et cetera, didn't know. One of the things, my mother was a very neat person, very fine dresser, very organized. Like I said, she had a ninth grade education. And at that time, in the 50s, that was high education. When she allowed my sister to go to school with her hair not combed, that was a sign that most folks knew that this is not right, because that's Mrs. Blake's daughter. And my sister came home and told my grandmother, you know, something's wrong with Mama because she don't do my hair, et cetera. And as old folks at that time did, they dismissed my sister and said, oh, there's nothing wrong. You just, girl, your mother does your hair, et cetera. But she would, you know, they would not really pick up on these signs. So these things I didn't know because I was 10 years old. All I knew, my mother could cook some macaroni, fry some chicken, and she sung this song, oh, what a friend we had in Jesus, and she always seemed happy. So when that happened, that was like that was shattering. It changed the course of the family. My grandmother was unable to really deal with it because she didn't understand mental illness, and she didn't, you know, it was something, you know, like if your finger isn't hurt or your leg isn't hurt, you know, you're all right. You know, don't be talking about you got nervousness. Stop that foolishness. That was my grandmother's, you know, understanding, you know, uneducated, not knowing. So they missed all the signs. And when it got to the point where she jumped out of that window, it was kind of late to come to the realization that something was really wrong with her. She went into the hospital. She was young at the time, and she spent over 50 years in that hospital. She actually was a young, very beautiful woman, dark, black, tall, long, silky hair. Just a very beautiful woman, but at, I'd say around about when she was 28, 29, 30, she went and took that jump. And never, never, ever came back to us as a mother. And then our family, you know, disintegrated, and we ended up in these different children's homes.
We're gonna get to each piece of the story, because I tell you, it's a very fascinating story. There are a lot of life lessons before we get to the mountaintop. We're getting ready to climb now, I'm telling you all. We're going to go into a few valleys, so put on your seatbelts. Let's situate your father. You had a father. You come from an intact family. You had sisters and brothers. Then you had, if I remember correctly, you had three. Tell us about your brothers. And first, just tell us about your dad.
Okay, my father was a Like I said, he had a third grade education, came from South Carolina. He was to me, he was like a superhero because he was a boxer, he was a bodybuilder, he was a very, very, very funny and lively and very warm individual. Now, I didn't understand that the problems between him and my wife, my mother, were as deep until one time I came home one day and he was like crying. I said, "Man, I couldn't believe this giant is crying," and you know, I just had a really bad feeling about that. But as a story progresses, the marital problems between both of them were very, very severe. My mother had really been in love with someone else, and that person died. I don't want to get too ahead of the book, but when you read the book, you'll see what happened to that particular individual and how that impacted my mother and how that eventually impacted my father and my and all of us. But my father did not live in the house that I can remember. I mean, I can't remember him sitting at the table having dinner with us. I can't remember getting up in the morning except for one time that he was there in the house. He had actually developed another family, and he was trying his best to manage the other family that he had developed as well as the family that he had. And he was not able to do that successfully. We ended up, and I'm saying we, that's my my two brothers, my brother, and four sisters. Yeah, four sisters. At the time, it was just my two boys, two girls, myself, my brother, and my two sisters. At that particular time, we ended up being moved out of the community into a children's home. I didn't know that when she jumped out the window that social workers were alerted to some issues in our family. And so they were coming by and they were finding out that, you know, we were more in the street, you know. As hard as my grandmother tried to corral us, she had her own children that she had to corral, plus she had to corral us, and we were a pretty wild bunch. And then when the landlord where we were living evicted my grandmother, he eventually evicted us, and we were left homeless, and the extended family was not able to step up to the plate because they were poor, trying to struggle themselves. And that's when they took us out of the community and placed us in a place called the Hebrew Children's Home. I'm following your directions, brother.
Yes, yes, sir. Yeah, you're doing a phenomenal job. I want you also, before we go to what happened in Jamaica, Queens, and you're being removed, I want you to first tell us about Islam was beginning, the Nation of Islam, that is, was budding also in Corona at that time. Minister Malcolm and Captain Joseph and many other famous figures were operating out of 105-01 Northern Boulevard, I believe. I'm sure you came in contact with them, and Minister Malcolm was living in East Elmhurst, where the Attorney General of the United States is originally from. So, I mean, you tease out the Muslim element in Corona, East Elmhurst.
Well, I actually, when I was around about 14, that place, 10501, was before it became a house of worship for Islam. It was a candy store. It was called the Wheat's Candy Store, where we all used to hang out and stand in the front and profile and shadow box and mess around and all that kind of stuff. It was a candy store. Wheat's Candy Store, right next to it, was a Graham's Barbershop. Now, I was standing in front of Wheat's Candy Store one weekend when I got released from the shelter. They let us come home on the weekend. I was looking for all my boys, couldn't find them. And then I ran into a young lady, a beautiful young lady in the neighborhood, older than I was. And she approached me and said, "Come on, I want you, Spade, I want you to go hear this guy named Malcolm." I said, "I don't want to hear no Malcolm. I'm going to wait for my boys." I waited, and they never showed up. I found that all of them had gotten arrested for something they did. So I had nothing to do, so I said, well, let me walk on down to East Elmhurst. I didn't like going to East Elmhurst because East Elmhurst was completely different from Corona in terms of the environment. It was upper middle class. People had cars. They had beautiful homes. They had beautiful lawns. And I remembered when I was going to PS 127 that I couldn't really talk to a lot of girls in East Elmhurst because their parents told them, stay away from them guys from Corona, you know, and those jitterbugs. And we were jitterbugs, you know. So their parents were giving them good advice. But I said, let me go on down there. And I went down there, and that's when I first saw Malcolm. And you got to read that in the book, I mean, because it was a profound experience. First of all, you know, when he walked into the place, he had such a presence and commanded such a presence. I had never seen these upper class, what I call at the time, and I'm speaking now from my point of view at that particular time. I don't feel that way now, but I have never seen such uppity Negroes get in order when he walked into that room. And I thought that was really, because these were arrogant brothers. They had a little more than everybody else. And you couldn't tell them nothing. I mean, you walked in the room, you just smelled the cologne and the perfume. They had all kinds of nice dresses. You know, for a poor boy from Corona, that was like, hey, I'm walking into like a dream world, you know. And when Malcolm walked in there and he said to them, he said, don't get afraid because you got these big homes and you got these big cars and you're worrying about what your boss is going to say because you came to hear Malcolm speak. He said, but let me tell you something. You don't own those homes. You don't own those cars. The white man owns everything you have. And that was a revelation for me. I said, you mean they don't own all that stuff? Because I thought they owned it, you know. He said, no. He said, they don't. He said, you don't own it. He said, everything you got belongs to the white man. Your job belongs to the white man. Your house belongs to the white man. The clothes you got on your back belong to the white man. He said, you don't have anything. Because you know nothing about doing anything for yourself. That was amazing. And they didn't fight. They listened. And when he finished, you know, and they crowded around him, and I walked out, and I said, man, that guy is something. Now, I thought that he was a Muslim. He was a Muslim. I thought the Muslims was a gang because all I knew was gangs, you know, who belonged to what gang. And I said to myself, man, that must be a bad gang leader, man. I like that gang. You're attracted to people who have no fear, and I was attracted to him because he didn't have any fear, and he took those uppity, arrogant people and reduced them to just human beings where they, you know, were like really catering to him. So that was my first impact with Malcolm and the Muslim. I don't want to go too far because you read the book.
Yeah, I want to also tell the people how they can get a copy of the book, and then I want to go back because this is first fascinating. Each way along the way is very many points. So I want to, first of all, before you kind of stole ahead of the story with the true story of how you ended up in the shelter. We don't want to go to the shelter yet. We want to situate you now. Mama has gone to the hospital. I believe, is at Pilgrim State. Grandma and the family. You know, I think that there's a myth, and you may can help me with it because you are a trained social worker, MSW, and my daughter is an aspiring social worker, and I hope she's listening.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of mythology about the strong African-American extended family. And I'm just about to share with you. I know that's not quite true because I had my first wife had a mental illness. Mm-hmm. Once she was in the hospital, I was struggling to had liens all over my home. And I know nobody in my family would assist me. So if it had not ended up in a welfare hotel, they would have been in the shelter system. So your dad tried to step in, and he put you in a place that, just tell us what happened after mom is not, grandma is no longer able to take care of you, or not to, well, she's not taking care of you, you know.
aunts, all the support systems are gone. You're pretty much, you and your sister and brother are fending for yourself and are pretty much dilapidated place. Tell us about those two habitations that you had prior to your an interruption that takes place.
Well, the first time we were taken from the community, we went to the Bronx, on Monroe Avenue, a place called the Hebrew Children's Home. And that place, it was all of us, my
brother. No, but I wanted to ask you about what happened when your father left you in that building and how someone must have reported you. Before you go to the shelter system, you were living in Corona, pretty much alone. You're cooking, you're eating. Louis Armstrong is feeding you all on the down low. That's that part of the narrative. Go to that, please.
Okay. We were living in on 107th Street, right next door to Louis Armstrong. There was no adult in the house. It was just us kids. I had been out of school for 90 consecutive days, played hooky. I was caught by a truant officer. You know, you used to have truant officers at that time.
Yes, sir.
And one of them came to my house, and I'm going fast because I don't want to give away too much about the book, but I'm just giving you the highlight. They discovered that there was no supervision, and it took me and my younger sister to a shelter in Jamaica called Queens Children's Shelter. It was on Union Hall Street right next to the family court at that time in Jamaica. And we ended up thinking that we were going to be there for like 2 weeks until my father found somebody to supervise us, and we ended up spending all of our adolescents, you know, in shelter and in homes. So, like I said, I'm just giving you highlights of it.
I don't want nobody to miss this. How much does this book cost? Let me tell you something, folks. This is well worth a Father's Day gift to your son, your husband, every African American, especially you students. You know, I worked at a college not far away from you. And, you know, students come with all these excuses. They never know our narrative. And we're going to go ahead and share some of your case studies of the students and come to you pretty, as we said, ragged in a bowl of yakum and greased as a pork chop, and how you shared with them your life story, because it's a powerful life story. Now, you end up with your sister and you are now separated. Tell us about that. Your sister and you worried about your sister. Yeah, go on, tell us that.
Yeah, I was basically looking out for her while we were in the shelter, and then because of my age, they found another place for me, a place called Woody Crest Children's Home, but that same place did not take young girls, my sister's age, so we ended up being split. It was a very painful experience because at that time we only had each other. So I spent the rest of my time in Woody Crest, and she went to a place called Hillcrest in upstate New York. It was a wretching, painful experience because at this protective, the first time I was totally separated from everybody and the family, and she was totally separated from everybody in the family. And as you read the book, you will find out what occurred, you know, in terms of
Dr. Bessie Blake did a fine job of describing the lady that came to get you the first time. I guess she's like, we used to call it in the old days, BCW, or the ACAS worker. Comes to the house, she bangs on the door. Basically, y'all not going to let her in. But in a sense, I guess you kind of had relief because what I say, you guys were having a hard time eating, having a meal, not in a particularly clean place. And Dad was doing the very best he could, but it seemed that Dad was kind of dysfunctional.
Right, you read that book very carefully, Brother Imam.
I read it three times because I wanted to make sure that first I was reading it for truth, second I had to read it because it was so painful because I one day I'm going to have you to interview me on the show so I can tell my life story because it's so painful. Like I say, I'm a reverse story in Corona. My life starts in East Elmhurst. as being the imam and Baltimore coming to East Elmhurst. And the first week I moved into the house at 103-26 Story Boulevard, my wife tried to kick the windows out. And I'm wondering what had happened to her. And found out she had a breakdown, and she had gone through the shelter system. She had been in Calgary Hall and all these places. So I'm reliving this very painfully. I mean, and we're going to talk about mental illness in the African-American community. We got a lot to talk about. We got about 40 minutes, so I want you to I want you to situate for us that lady knocking on the door and what it was like for, I think you were about a 12-year-old child and your sister, when y'all were grabbed, forcibly taken to the Queens Supreme Juvenile Court. That building still stands today. And then I want you to comment on the whole foster care system.
Well, we were actually taken to the family court. It was not a court as such. It was a family court. You make a family
court. Family court, yeah.
That's when the judge made the decision that we were not to return to that unsupervised house right next door to Louis Armstrong with no lights, no gas, no food, no anything. And he said that until my father got an adult to supervise us, we could not return to that house. And my father assured us that he would get somebody from Florida or South Carolina to come up and take care of us. Then moving forward, he was unable to do that, and our response and reaction to that, 2 weeks turned into 2 months, 2 months turned into 6 months, and ended up, you know, only a number of years before we were liberated from that system. The worker who came to the house was a tough-minded Italian woman, and she had that attitude where you're not going to scare me. And I tried my best to scare her in every kind of way, but she was not having it, and she left after I didn't let her in and came back with the police, and they made us open the door and took us away. I had no idea at that particular point in time that I would be leaving my community for good, in the sense that I would never be intact or entrenched in that community again. I was 12 years old. It would seem preposterous that I would not be back in my community playing my same old game, running with the same old gang, hanging out with the same old fellas. When that was shattered, that was a turning point in my life as well as my sister's life. Then we were put into the system, not given much support, no real understanding, dysfunctional social workers who really didn't understand how to communicate with me and my sister. You know, I was angry. I lost my mother, lost my father, lost my community, lost my mac and cheese and fried chicken and all that stuff that make living in the hood, living in the hood. And somebody, you know, come and ask me, how am I doing? I thought that was the most preposterous question a social worker can ask. You know, how am I doing? Well, hell, how do you think I'm doing after going through all
I agree with you 1,000%. How you doing? You're away from your family, traumatized, and how you doing? Now, you know, I want to, before I ask some policy questions, because we have about 30 more minutes here, and I just want to get some policy. But I do want to get a part of this narrative in. And that part of the narrative is dealing with, you are now, one part of your book there is you're at Woody Crest, and we're going to go, later on we'll go back to Woody Crest and what that means for Muslims in New York area. But you were at Woody Crest Avenue in the Bronx, overlooking Yankee Stadium. And there came a time that one of the councils, I believe, molested one of the boys in there. Share with us that, and just this whole systemized thought with abuse and misuse. I'm not knocking everybody in the foster care system, you all. But I mean,
well,
it's,
you know,
just, yes.
Yeah, I talk about the more or less the emotional abuse, even though there was a lot of other abuse going on in those places, because sometimes they would hire, counselors, male counselors who had other persuasions. You know, they were like, gay, you call them. They, at the time, we call them homosexuals. But anyway, they would hire them. And so you have to always be on guard because, you know, You got a place where kids are vulnerable. They have lost their loved ones. They feel alone. They feel isolated. They're angry, and so they're vulnerable. So I have to always be on my guard because of these kinds of situations. Being in Woody Crest was the struggle for me. In Woody Crest was that they, like in most of the institutions, consider you a successful child if you conform to the institution. Well, that meant that I would have to lose my individuality. I had to struggle, to keep my individuality. They made us line up to go to breakfast and line up to go to the gym and line up to go to bed and line up to take showers. Everything was group-oriented, and if you did not conform to the group, you were considered a bad kid. And I felt that, in those institutions, that you have to strike a balance. You have to help these are policy issues now that I'm talking about. You have to strike a balance. You have to allow for individual growth, but at the same time help a young man or a young girl deal in a cooperative way with the institution. You can't ram down and define a kid as good or bad by how much he conforms to the institution, because there were institutional rules that needed to be challenged, and God had put that spirit in me to challenge things that I thought were wrong. So I was considered bad. I was considered someone not to, by the other kids, don't associate with him. When I got information about, my African history and my roots, as one of the counselors shared with me, I became like a Mau Mau. He's always talking that mumble-jumble stuff. Anything to rob a person of their individuality. I remember one incident, we were standing in line, and one of the administrator's wife, a white woman, came up to us and started straightening our tie. And she would say, "Straighten out your tie for mommy." And she got to me, I knocked her hand. I said, "You're not my mother." That was like, how could he do that to the administrator's wife? Well, what do you mean? I miss my mother, and you're going to stand here and straighten my tie and tell me you're my mother? Get out of here. And that was my attitude. And I told the other kids, don't let her call you. Make her call you mother. You got mothers. If you don't have mothers, you had one, but she wasn't one. So they considered me a rebel, and I was, because I didn't consciously decide to be a rebel, but I had a sense of what was right and what was wrong, and what was good and what was bad, and I knew that just to conform to the system and submit to a system that was wrong was not something I could do. And I had a combative spirit, coming from Corona. You learned how to fight. And
you also came from the Toomer family, and you had watched your uncles. They didn't take any wooden nickels and probably not metal nickels either. Also, when you first went to that shelter, I believe they were ready to beat you up. And you didn't wait for your woman to come. You jumped across the bed and terrorized that young boy and established a reputation that not only not somebody going to be a chump, but you serve the role of being a protector for the weak and vulnerable young people, which even today you have. From the first time I met you, I was in bad standing in the temple, and you had a very fiery spirit, and I will never forget that. And now I know where that spirit came from. Yes, sir.
Right.
Continue, Dean, there may be some young brother right now who's being bullied in the public school or in the foster care system, right now being bullied. And even though I think this boy was bigger than you, you brought it to him and you gave him a message with no return address on it.
Absolutely. Now, and one of the things that that was something that was put in me a love of children, because I saw children in these institutions in the worst shape, In fact, when I first went to the shelter, at night I can hear these kids calling out to their mothers and grinding their teeth, and I was so overwhelmed by their pain, I couldn't think too much about my own, and I believe today that's when God put a love of children in my heart to help them to do whatever I can to make things better for them. That's another reason why I wanted this book to be written, because I
I think, Dean, you should do workshops. I think there's a lot of young, what we call at-risk young people. If they could hear your story, if they could be in a workshop with you, look, what worse than have your mother dissolve right before your very eyes? For your daddy to shrivel before your very eyes. I mean, you know, this is what's in God's bad boy. I mean, we, you know, it. Now, I want to get some good stuff out of here, because all of it is not bad. You meet a man in the shelter. I mean, Woody Crest. And let's just quickly give us Woody Crest's history and how it ended up being a Muslim facility. But I want you to tell us about that man that turned your life around. You were pretty much ready to be a rebel with or without a cause. But there was a gentleman there that was a counselor who saw through your pain. And this is what you all who were teaching school and doing social work with young people. I don't care, the baddest bully in the world has a story attached to it. And even though you had kind of broke bad and you had become speed one, you know, perhaps if rap music come out, your reputation with somebody walk up to speed number three, we'll know that who they're talking about. You know, like 50 Cent is a stolen name from the Fort Greene Project. So,
well, let me tell you about
situate. Yes, sir.
Let me tell you about this social worker. It was a social worker, as I had many social workers. And I said to you earlier that they spent more time ignoring my pain than speaking to my pain. And they would do it by asking me questions about how are you doing. And they knew the answer, that I wasn't doing well. Then I met this social worker who basically changed my life, because he got me to absolutely open up and talk about my vision and my aspiration in life. And the way he did it was, he started off before he even introduced himself and his name. He said, "You are an angry MF." I said, he hit it right on the head. "You doggone right, I'm angry." He said, "But you know something?" He said, then he began to talk to me like a real person. That's why, you know, in social work, any social work school that's worth any salt should help social workers learn how to put themselves in the other person's shoes. It's called empathy. Empathy, to be able to look at a situation and empathize. And that's what this man, Tilly, name was Tom Tilly, was able to do. He looked at my situation and he put himself, he said, "You were angry." He said, "You're mad because your damn family fell apart." You know, he started hitting all those thoughts that I had deep inside of me. And I said, "This, I can communicate with him." So he showed empathy. But not only that, he came with some concrete ways in which to make change. And he gave me some instructions and help and understanding about how to arrive at the things. First of all, I never told any of the social workers what I wanted. And what I really wanted was to reunite my family. That was the thing that hurt me more than anything, losing my family. Because by that time, I had two young sisters in foster care, 4 and 5 years old. I didn't know where they were, where their foster homes were. When I finally got a chance to find out where they were, I went to visit them and talk with them. But I wanted to reunite my family. I wanted to take these pieces that were shattered and make them whole again. And when I told that man that, he was like, "Well, you know, if you want to do something like that, you have to have an education." And I said, "I don't have no education, man. I'm just going to get me a job after high school." And he said, "But you can do more for your family with a college degree than you can with a high school diploma." But he began to engage me in strategies. This is how you do it. He said, "You're a smart kid." He said, "But your smartness is going to go anywhere because you're not allowing your potential to develop." And so when you see in the book the kind of things that he and I talked about and how he guided me and helped me, I ended up getting a full scholarship to college, North Carolina.
Yeah, that's what I want you to talk about. Now, the story's moving on. Boy, it's powerful. You are going to North Carolina, as we call it at the time. That was like, to us, that would be like the University of Virginia, North Carolina College, in the time that you went there. We didn't have many other choices to go, but you went to North Carolina College. You finished high school, still in foster care, and Now you go to North Carolina College. That must have been a culture shock to go behind the Iron Curtain or the Bamboo Curtain. Segregation. Corona is somewhat segregated, but it's not nowhere near North Carolina. Just wait for us. First, tell us, what is North Carolina College? Where it's located, and the time and period which you came there.
I left September 1960. It was nothing but segregation in North Carolina. In fact, Woody Crest Committee, who gave me the scholarship, wanted me to go to NYU because they said, you know, you're too feisty, you're a fighter, you go down there, you're going to get yourself in trouble because it's a racist society, et cetera. But the thing that attracted me to North Carolina is because I never in all the years I'd been in New York had a black teacher. And when I saw a yearbook of North Carolina Central and I saw all these black professors and black football teams and black basketball teams and black marching band, I could not believe it that such a place existed. So I told the committee, I'm going to North Carolina, whether you give me the scholarship or not, because I wanted to be in an environment where people who looked like me were making progress. I had been around folks who were not making progress, who looked like me. I did not know there was such a thing as a black college. And so I was so passionate about it, they decided to say, well, we'll let you go for 1 year and see how things work out. Well, when I got on that bus to go to North Carolina, I had no idea of the heavy segregation, racist environment that I was going into. And I realized that when I got to Richmond, Virginia, and tried to get something to eat, and the woman totally ignored me until a black woman pulled me out of the restaurant and said, you got to read the sign, son. Did you see this restaurant? It says white only. You got to go where it says colored. You see this water fountain? It says white water fountain. You got to go where the color. The bathroom, same thing. So everything, you have to read the signs. If you don't, you're going to get yourself in trouble. Now, that was the first time I actually came to a full realization of what people were talking about. When I got to North Carolina Central University, however, I saw all those beautiful black women and the buildings and green grass. I mean, it was like heaven. And to tell you frankly, I wasn't concerned about segregation because everything I needed was on that black college campus. I didn't need to go into the city. I was happy, you know, with just being amongst my people, these beautiful students, these faculty members. It was like a dream that did come true. In fact, it wasn't a dream. It was like a realization because I didn't even dream that there was anything.
And
like
something else great happened at North Carolina Central University. We got an African-American love story there. Tell us about that love story. You're a player up on the Himalayas. You're coming in North Carolina. You're popular with the guys and all y'all hanging out. You're finding your civil rights is fermenting. And suddenly, Cupid strikes your heart. Tell us about that.
A year before.
That you're still with 50 years now, still reigning queen of being Captain Muhammad's life.
And when I first
Dr. Blake,
saw
her, I hope you're listening. Love
She's not here. She's out with my daughter. But listen, when I first saw her, I had a dream. I did have the dream a year before I saw her. And I knew who she was, who she looked like, et cetera. So when I was on the campus, when I saw her walking, I told a friend of mine, I said, hey, man, that's the girl I'm going to marry. And he said, oh, Blake, man, you don't even know her, man. I said, I know, but that's the girl I'm going to marry. Well, long story short, and you'll read it in the book, all the things I had to go through, but she ran from me. She did not want anything to do with me. I had to chase her. I had to kind of use the best lines that I could, but none of them were working. Until one day, because she was a graduate student at the time in literature, so I said, I got to come at her a different way. I got to do some reading and talk some literature to her. So the literature that I knew was about Malcolm, you know, and I started having a discussion about Malcolm X and the Muslims, et cetera. And she thought that was interesting. She had never heard anything like that, you know, about the Nation of Islam, Malcolm, you know, because I had just read the book when the word was given, et cetera. And we struck up a conversation. And to make a long story short, she decided that we would be friends because she was already engaged and she wasn't looking for any kind of connection. And I said, great, because this poor lady doesn't know that she's my wife, but I'll just play along with her. You know, just be patient, wait my time. So we became best friends, best friends. At least she thought we were best friends. She was my wife. And then when I left North Carolina for Christmas, after seeing her practically every day from October to December, that's when she realized she was in love with me. And let me tell you something. I chased her then, and I'm still chasing her after 50 years. And I'll chase her
till I... All praise is due to Almighty God. You know, this is a very powerful story. And I'm going to tell you something. That's another reason to attend these historical African-American colleges. You know, I want to deem one of the things we are planning to do on this broadcast is to have a historical African-American black college and university day. We want to have one day a week that we dedicate to featuring one of the historical black colleges. We've been promoting them. We want people to attend them because I still think it's the best buy. I also think it's a place where you can get mentoring. Now, you, what is weird about you, and I said this is weird, I always thought you would have been a sociology major, but I was shocked, literally shocked, when I found out you were a chemistry major.
Right. Yes.
It doesn't fit Dean talking to me and Muhammad in a lab with, you know, burning chemicals. You would think you somewhere, you know, working on that. But this is the side of people we never know. Tell us about that, how you ended up in the sciences, coming from Woody Grass and going to school. I believe you went to Truman High School. Yes.
I tell my students, you know, when I got to college, because I was the first person in my family to go to college, I didn't understand things like major, minor, curriculum, transcript, matriculation, non-matriculation. None of those words were never part of my vocabulary. So when I got to my dorm and I met my roommate who was from North Carolina, and he asked me, he said, hey, Blake, what are you going to major in? I didn't know what he was talking about. So I just said, well, I don't know. I just dismissed it. I said, I don't know. Then he said, well, I tell you one thing. You better not major in chemistry. I said, why? He said, because you'll never make it. Well, you know, I'm only like 17. I'm from New York. You never tell somebody 17 from New York, you better not do this, you better not do that. So I took that on as a challenge, you know, to tell me, how is this man going to tell me what I can or cannot do? So in spite, I majored in chemistry. And that's how I got in chemistry. And once I got into that organic chemistry, qualitative analysis, quantitative analysis, physical chemistry, once I got into that, I couldn't get out because those classes were 5 credits. So if you took those classes, you had 10 credits. You change your major at that point, you're going backwards instead of forward. So I had to stay in there and you know, just survive and graduate with that degree. Now, chemistry was very important because it helped me in social work and psychology because it's talking about the physical relationship between matter, you know, complete elements, incomplete elements, elements coming together, losing their property, and becoming compounds. And when they operate independently, they have so much power. But when they unite, they change their character, and they have greater use and greater power. And I'm able to use that in helping my students understand that they're like chemicals themselves. They're all looking for some sense of completion. They're all looking for an opportunity to connect with someone else to have a better life. They all have to, at some point, lose some of their properties and give it up to unite with others. There's always compromises and uniting. So the chemistry really helped me not only understand the physical relationship to matter in society and in the world, but in psychological, the mental, you know, as well, because the physical is like really a reflection of what happens mentally or spiritually. Did I answer your question?
Certainly did. And also, I want you to tell us about that challenge you had. You had one course to complete. I think you were near graduation, and you used all that energy from Corona Woody crashed the shelter, and you bust through a course. I think this particular professor basically told you you are not going to graduate. Again, a New Yorker from Corona, that's a hell of a challenge to lay down. Now, many brothers would have laid down on that one. But
that's
something
right.
within you he made you have... Yes, go ahead.
He was not only... He was the most difficult chemistry professor at the college. He had a reputation as being very difficult, and I needed to make an A in organic chemistry, which was one of the most demanding and challenging chemistry courses, you know, in the curriculum. And when that man told me, and then I had gotten married by then, and I had a family and responsibilities. I had to graduate. I needed that degree. And so when he told me that, Blake, you're not going to make it. You know, you got to get an A. I don't see you making an A. I took that on, and I said, you know something? I'm going to take this on just like I pursued my wife. I'm going to pursue this A. I'm not going to let nothing stop me because I had to have Bessie as my wife, and I had to have this A. So I took on that mental attitude of I'm going to succeed. I don't care what anyone says, and specifically what he says. And I devoted my time, my energy, and every waking hour to hitting those books, learning those formulas, doing those experiments in the laboratory, and as God would have it, I made the A. I was the happiest person on that campus when I got that A, because that meant that I can go home, get a job, take care of my family, and be a man. I was 20 at the time, 21 at the time, but I had
now you graduate. Now, okay, let's go to a station break. You can. If you want to join the conversation, you can dial 805-727-7013. Those who are listening via the phone, all you got to do is press 1 on the phone, and you will be assisted. I want to say to Dean Taqbir Muhammad and others who may not have the opportunity to listen to this program now, tell your friends, tell your brothers, tell your sisters, all they got to do is go to www.blogtalkradio.com and /religionmeansalive and put in today's date. And you can listen to the broadcast. Maybe you and your church group would like to listen to this. Maybe you and your fraternal group. Maybe in your alumni chapter. But everybody, particularly on Staten Island, I hope you are listening. Because there are many of our young people on Staten Island have been feel like they have been abandoned. They were too old to go to foster care, so they've been in group homes. And there are thousands of our young people languishing on Staten Island. But if you heard about this program and then go to get the book, God's Bad Boy by Dr. Bessie Blake, I think you will have a convincing reason why you would be able to meet your challenge. I don't care if it's organic chemistry. I don't care what is going on. In fact, if your life is incoherent, turn bottom side upward. This is a story of how to, and also a story of love. You know, people knock African-American men and women getting married. They said that, oh, we don't get married. But we just heard a story of a man that pursued a woman who was already engaged, a graduate student, which means she had degrees above him. But Dean, with his knockout punch, didn't give up. So now you're back in Corona. In Eastern, you graduate NCC.
Brother Eman, let me just interject.
Yes.
My wife and I gave a workshop at the college called Love, Marriage, and Family in celebration of our 50th wedding anniversary. We did no publicity. We mentioned it to a few students. We got a classroom for 60 people. By the time this program started, there was no room in the classroom. People were clamoring to get in, no pre-publicity, but they wanted to know about love, marriage, and family, and how did this black couple sustain 50 years of marriage. So there is a great thirst out there for young people who want to connect and build a life together. God's Bad Boy will share with you our experiences, and hopefully you can learn from those experiences and make the kind of commitment to family that is so critical for our growth and development as a people.
Dean, I want you to now share, you're back in Corona, and I want to, for us to tell people how you're married, you got your degree, first one in the family. Now you got to get a job and translate that into making money and see what you can do for your sisters, your mother, your family. How did you end up back? What did you do to get you into the field of the social work, how you took this path to social work? Let's tease it out from there.
Well, you know, again, I'll give you themes, and then you can read the book for details. But after graduating from college, we set up household in Corona, actually, and then eventually moved to East Elmhurst and started a family of our own. We now have 4 children and 7 grandchildren, and we, you know, been working and supporting each other. The greatest support I had was my wife in terms of, you know, going on to graduate school, and she went on and got her doctorate at Columbia University. Then she became a close aide to Rosa Parks and worked very closely with Gordon Parks. I supported her in her profession. If you read the book, it'll tell you all about the marital changes that took place in our life that changed the actual relationship over a period of time because, you know, things shifted in terms of responsibility and the different roles that we had to play. Now, Brother Imam, this is detailed stuff that I have suggested that folks read this book, and your questions have been absolutely penetrating and very comprehensive, and I fear that if I answer all your questions in detail, there'll be no need for the book.
I don't want you to, because I tell you, I don't want to take this. No, look, if I go into a movie.
This is one of the best interviews I've had, and it really makes a difference when somebody is interviewing you and pulling out of you information the way you have been able to pull out of me. And I have to say, my wife says to me when we go to book signings, she says, you talk too much. You tell too many things. Let them read the book. Because I'm a talker.
You know what? I'm going to tell you something.
I'm a talker. So I have to, I said, wow, this brother is asking me some penetrating questions. So I have to kind of craft my answers.
You know, I want you to, but I tell you something. Nothing like reading a book. I laughed. I first cried because I said, Dean Blake has stolen, has stolen my story. It's a reverse story. I'm telling you, this is really, I started out East Elmhurst, went to Corona, ended up in the shelters with my 4 children, barely survived, and ended back up in Corona again. So, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is, because I want to now, we're going to get away from your particular story, and we got about 15 minutes, we're going to tease out some issues. One of those issues is the issue of mental health. It's a missing link in the African-American community. It's an even missing link in the religious community, the Muslim community, and another missing link is the issue of social work. We think we can pray it out, salat it out, Ramadan it out, but mental health is a major piece in our lives. And I want you to share that because it's a powerful story about your mom, but it's also a cautionary tale about your mom. It's also a cautionary tale about the foster care system. And I just want you to share with us this whole mental health piece. Now I want you to depart. We won't let you steal any more out of the book. We're going to talk to you as a social worker and a policymaker about the whole issue of mental health. Will you share with us your opinion?
I mentioned some policy issues in the book and some mental health issues that impact on our community. And you're absolutely right. This mental health is a big problem, not only in our community, but in America, but specifically the resources available to help people in our community is limited. But I talk about mental illness, the pain, my mother, et cetera. But you know something? I got to tell you something. My wife just walked into the room. Would you like to say something to her?
Yes, I would. Let me first tell Dr. Blake that Dr. Blake, you have been given another doctorate. Religion Means a Lot confers on you a doctorate of human letters because you have given us such a wonderful book. I would even thought it was a novel. I thought that Down That Mean Street, Daddy Was a Number Runner, all the great novels, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing. I don't think any of those pieces of literature reaches Antoine Fisher, none of this reaches the literary flourishes that you reach. It's, and you write it in the first person. And I had the feeling that the window incident, I ain't going to share too much more of it. I don't want to steal the story. Because I want you to, I can actually visualize that house next to Louis Armstrong. It should be a movie. You are a cinematic writer. So I'm going to shut up, Dr. Blake, and allow a doctor to come to the mic and share with us whatever poignant observations you have about God's bad boy and your authorship.
Well, thank you, Imam Alfred, and it's good to speak to you today. It was quite, a favor or a grace by God to be able to write God's Bad Boy. And my observations came from 50 years of living with my husband, God's Bad Boy. And, as we would talk, scenes would just come back to me from over the years that we spent together.
You did a wonderful job. It's kind of hard to do biographical writing when you're involved. I made the mistake of putting on Bobby Womack and trying to tell my own story about my own encounter with the mental health system, my first wife having a mental illness, my children almost being in the shelter system. Just it's so painful. And to live with a loved one, that story, sometimes it just can bring you to tears. So the mastery of your narrative is powerful, your control of the material. Now, I want you to share just a bit about you. I want you to tell us who you are, because I remember you when you were the dean of School of New Resources. I believe you are the founding dean of the School of New Resources at the College of New Resources.
Not the founding dean, but I was the dean for more than 20 years. And the School of New Resources was a school for adult learners. And that was really a very rewarding experience to see how education can empower a person. And I was particularly interested then in writing and teaching people how to write and how to best express themselves in the written word, because many of the students came into the classroom and they had very good speaking skills, but they were terrified to put something down on the page. And I thought, well, to have writing as a skill and a tool is very empowering. So I did a lot to build up that particular part of the curriculum.
Well, I must tell you, Dean, you created a big problem. You created a big problem for me because I couldn't put the book down. I was hoping you would give me a pause. I said, I got to read what happened next. So I started, read the book, and then I said, every week, I'm going to get prepared. I can't be among professors and scholars and not be prepared. So Sam Parker used to always say, be prepared. So I decided I had to reread it two or three times. First was I read it just for the narrative power. Then second, I read it because it rich and emotional compared to a lifestyle I had experienced. And I was just reading it again because I really enjoyed it. And I like what the great pastor, Alfonso Watts, who was also a neighbor of mine, his mother and family, said about the book. And I agree with him. I think it's a very, very powerful, powerful, powerful narrative. I want to, you all have had a strong example of an interfaith relationship. You're a woman of Christianity. I'm a former Baptist preacher. I have commend you all that you all have worked better together, worked so wonderful together, 50 years. What was it like just to hold 50 years of marriage together? Now, I'm going to steal nothing from the book, but tell us, both of you in your own words, what it's like to be together 50 years in peace.
Well, brother, I always tease my wife or at a book signing. I said, we've been married for 50 years. Her next book is going to be, I've been married for 50 years. I must be crazy. But the 50 years, like I said to you before, it's the common bond and love we have of God and the presence of God in our lives. Is a glue that has helped us climb many, many mountains. Another thing is that I would say that my wife has an expression, I'll let her break it down, that we've been married, I think it's 8 times to the same person. Let her break it down to you.
Well, yes, 8 times or more. Have we been married over the 50 years? And the thing, I think, from my perspective, that was crucial in making our marriage a success and making it last is both of us were willing to give and take. We were willing to compromise. We were willing to listen to one another and be flexible and just admit that, okay, maybe I can grow in this area, or maybe I can grow over here where you're saying I can grow. And also, I called it renegotiating the contract. Like, the one set of roles we had worked for a certain period of time, and then as our family grew and our job responsibilities grew, we would sometimes have to shift the roles a little bit so that everyone could, both of us, could have a fulfilling life.
And you know what? We can tell you that you all are in love together because sometimes one person told me my dad and mom were married for 50 years, but it seemed that they were married to make each other miserable. And you know, you heard these marriages and people say, I've been married for 50 years. And then you heard a woman say, oh, I love my husband. And I know from studying marital counsel 101, when she said, I love my husband, 9 times out of 10, she really wants to say she hated her husband. But that's the case. But you all have, you know, one thing you didn't sugarcoat it. You talk about the difficulties of negotiating a public and private life and all
right.
of the ups and downs. That's what I think is so real. See, I mean, people think that marriage is made of peaches and cream and every day they live happily ever after and they tiptoe through the tulips. And everything is beautiful. Life is not quite like that, is it?
No. It's work. You really have to be willing to work at it. And I was fortunate enough, and I think my husband was blessed too, to have my mother in our lives. And she was a source of guidance to us and saying, oh,
wow.
I wouldn't do it that way. And, well, don't be so quick to do this or that. So one of the things I think we lack today, which my husband and I are trying to, you know, speak more to young people about love and marriage. But, you know, the one generation passing on what wisdom they have to the generation that's coming up. And so people jump into marriage and they think it's just romance. And they have this too many sitcoms or romantic comedies or something, you know, they think that's what marriage is all about. So,
and personally for me, as I mentioned to my wife when we first met, was that it was really important not having a dad in my home when I was growing up. I did not want my children to have that same experience. And it was like a commitment that I had made to myself, and I shared it with my wife. I said, listen, we get married, we're going to have a revolutionary marriage. She said, well, what do you mean by that? I said, we're not getting divorced. And I really meant that because I know the pain of not having that guidance in the home. So in this book, I talk about the importance of fatherhood, motherhood, the fact that just being in the house doesn't make you a father, but if you engage with your children that you bring into the world, you know, that's what makes you a father, whether you're in the house, because you got some fathers in the house or not fathers. I wanted to be a father, and I needed a partner to do that and build a strong family, break the cycle of deterioration that took place in my family, break that chain, start a whole new a cycle of progress, prosperity, education, and achievement. And I look at my children, and I look at my grandchildren, and I can say, oh, Allahu Akbar, God has blessed me, because they're bright, they're smart, they're going places they have never experienced what I've experienced, and I thank God for having a partner like Dr. Bessie Blake, my queen, my friend.
Are you all planning to make a movie out of this? You know, there are three or four movies that jump out of this book. I mean, a love story, you're struggling. I just think that this is the power. You know, there's one lady famous on TV. I'm going to use her name. I don't care. She's always talking, you've got to do the work. And this lady, to me, is an example of people who haven't done any work. But anyway, you know, such is life. But I think that you all have shown me that you have done the work. You've shown that this is not an easy life. And marriage is not easy. But I'm going to stop here and ask you for a few minutes to give us a commercial, because we are here to sell books. We are here, and before I do it, let me ask for donations. I mean, this ministry is not free. I want nobody to get the illusion that Blog Talk Radio and Mr. Alan Levy, the president, allowed me to come on for free. It cut me off a minute. We've been broadcasting nearly 3 years. We intend to be on longer. So, and we intend to take this to mainstream radio every 7 days a week and on to television. So you can send your donations to Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey. Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. And it's our intent to take this program on the road. We want to come to Jamaica. We want to come to Fort Greene. We want to come to all the sections of New York, New Jersey. We want to have the Dr. Blake to invite young people, maybe in the foster care, bring them to these meetings. And we're not here to convert people to Muslim, Christian. We're to convert our people to our humanity. So with that, let me shut up and let Dean and his wife, the doctor, tell us how we can get a copy of this fascinating, phenomenal work. I don't know what other adjectives I can use. Dean, I may need a course in writing just to describe it.
Well, you can get the book at several places. You can get it at litlore.com. That's LITLORE.com. You can also get it at Amazon.com. Or you can get it at BarnesandNobles.com, and you're asking for God's Bad Boy by Dr. Bessie W. Blake.
Say it again.
So that's LitLore.com, Amazon.com, or BarnesandNobles.com, and ask for God's Bad Boy by Dr. Bessie W. Blake. And if you go to Amazon.com, you will see several five-star reviews of God's Bad Boy.
Dr. Blake, you are author of some other books. Would you share with us the name of those books?
Well, I wrote Speak to the Mountain, the Tommy Waits story, which is a family history of my family in East Texas, Louisiana area of the country, and it chronicles my mother's journey to the ministry, those forces in her family life that shaped her. It goes two generations back into slavery and comes to the new millennium. So that's Speak to the Mountain, the Tommy Waits story by myself, Dr. Bessie W. Blake, and it's also on Amazon.com and BarnesandNobles.com. Then the publishing company that I started, Litlore.com, published a collection of poetry called The Gifted Quiet, Poems and Performance Words by Rashana Blake, and it's a very inspirational piece for young people. That's, you know, a collection of poetry written by my daughter, and she did such a beautiful reading at our 50th anniversary celebration last Saturday.
But that film was your anniversary film?
Say that again.
Did they film it?
Yeah.
Did they record it? My question was...
My son is working on a video of
good,
the anniversary.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. Because that should be published as well. You know, any time we want to work on developing healthy African-American families, we need
right.
these kind of narratives and stories. I mean, your ups and downs. I know it wasn't peaches and cream or bean pie and ice cream. Life is not meant to be that. And the people of faith know that life is very difficult. I just one of the things that I don't want to make a lot of commentary, but I do have to say, you know, we have a preacher on TV. Everything is big smiles. Everything's like bubblegum. Well, I'm yeah. happy to tell you, Reverend, it's not like that. You know, everything in the lions won't lay down with the sheep. They're going to bite them. So life is just like this. We have lions in our lives, and we'll try to consume us. But as long as we have Dr. Blake and Dr. Muhammad, we're going to be all right. Peace be on. I thank you all for coming on the program. It's been a moving program. I really appreciate the work you're doing, and I hope everybody will get a copy of God's Bad Boy, because God has shown his power in transforming lives on a daily basis. He's taking them from Woody Crest to the mountaintop. God bless you. His peace be on you and your family. And look forward to all of you seeing you tomorrow on Religion Means a Lot. Tell your friends, tell your sisters, tell your brothers that they want to get a copy of this. All they got to do is go to www.blogtalkradio.com /Religion Means Alive, or put a plus size, Religion Means Alive, put in today's date, and you will be able to listen to it. We want this to be downloaded for the June 17, 2014, and you heard the program again. Thank you. Peace be on you. Thanks again. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow on Religion Means Alive.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Email.